Go on, you can stand some more, or something of the kind. The dreamer is thus forced to taste and praise what is offered. But that's good. After he is alone again with his wife, he scolds about the neighbor's importunity and about the quality of the food he has tasted. I can't stand the sight of it. A phrase not appearing even in the dream as an actual speech is a thought which has reference to the physical charms of the lady who invites him, and which would be translated as meaning that he does not want to look at her. The analysis of another dream which I cite at this point for the sake of the very distinct speech that forms its nucleus, but which I shall explain only when we come to consider emotions in the dreams, will be more instructive. I dream very distinctly. I have gone to Brooker's laboratory at night, and upon hearing a soft knocking at the door, I open it to the deceased, Professor Fleischl, who enters in the company of several strangers, and after saying a few words sits down at his table. Then follows a second dream. My friend F.L. has come to Vienna in July without attracting much attention. I meet him on the street while he is in conversation with my deceased friend P., and I go somewhere or other with these two, and they sit down opposite each other as though at a little table, while I sit at the narrow end of the table facing them. F.L. tells about his sister and says, "In 3/4 of an hour she was dead," and then something like, "That is the threshold." As P. does not understand him, F.L. turns to me and asks me how much I have told of his affairs. Whereupon, seized by strange emotions, I want to tell F.L. that P. can't possibly know anything because he is not alive. But noticing the mistake myself, I say, "Non vixit." Then I look at P. searchingly, and under my gaze he becomes pale and blurred, his eyes a morbid blue, and at last he dissolves. I rejoice greatly at this. I now understand that Ernest Fleischl, too, was only an apparition, a revenant, and I find that it is quite possible for such a person to exist only as long as one wants him to, and that he can be made to disappear by the wish of another person. This beautiful dream unites so many of the characteristics of the dream content which are problematic. The criticism made in the dream itself, in that I myself notice my mistake in having said non vixit instead of non vivit, the unconstrained intercourse with dead persons whom the dream itself declares to be dead, the absurdity of the inference, and the intense satisfaction which the inference gives me, that by my life I should like to give a complete solution of these problems. But in reality I am incapable of doing this, namely the thing I do in the dream, of sacrificing such dear persons to my ambition. With every revelation of the true meaning of the dream, with which I am well acquainted, I should have been put to shame. Hence I am content with selecting a few of the elements of the dream for interpretation, some here, and others later on another page. The scene in which I annihilate P. by a glance forms the center of the dream. His eyes become strange and weirdly blue, and then he dissolves. This scene is an unmistakable copy of one really experienced. I was a demonstrator at the Physiological Institute and began my service in the early hours, and Brooker learned that I had been late several times in getting to the school laboratory. So one morning he came promptly for the opening of the class and waited for me. What he said to me was brief and to the point, but the words did not matter at all. What overwhelmed me was the terrible blue eyes through which he looked at me, and before which I melted away, as P. does in the dream, for P. has changed roles with him, much to my relief. Anyone who remembers the eyes of the great master, which were wonderfully beautiful until old age, and who has ever seen him in anger, can easily imagine the emotions of the young transgressor on that occasion. But for a long time I was unable to account for the non vixit with which I execute sentence in the dream, until I remembered that these two words possessed such great distinctness in the dream, not because they were heard or spoken, but because they were seen. Then I knew at once where they came from. On the pedestal of the statue of Emperor Joseph in the Hofburg at Vienna may be read the following beautiful words: "Salutai patrii vixit non diu sed totus." I had culled from this inscription something which suited the one inimical train of thought in the dream thoughts, and which now intended to mean, "That fellow has nothing to say. He is not living at all." And I now recalled that the dream was dreamed a few days after the unveiling of the memorial to Fleischl in the arcades of the university, upon which occasion I had again seen Brooker's statue, and must have thought with regret, in the unconscious, how my highly gifted friend P., with his great devotion to science, had forfeited his just claim to a statue in these halls by his premature death. So I set up this memorial to him in the dream. The first name of my friend P is Joseph. According to the rules of dream interpretation, I should still not be justified in replacing non-vivid, which I need, by non-vixit, which is placed at my disposal by the recollection of the Joseph monument. Something now calls my attention to the fact that in the dream scene, two trains of thought concerning my friend P meet, one hostile, the other friendly, of which the former is superficial, the latter veiled, and both are given representation in the same words, non-vixit. Because my friend P has deserved well of science, I erect a statue to him, but because he has been guilty of an evil wish, which is expressed at the end of the dream, I destroy him. I have here constructed a sentence of peculiar resonance, and I must have been influenced by some model. But where can I find similar antithesis, such a parallel between two opposite attitudes towards the same person, both claiming to be entirely valid, and yet both trying not to encroach upon each other? Such a parallel is to be found in a single place, where, however, a deep impression is made upon the reader, in Brutus's speech of justification in Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. As Caesar loved me, I weep for him. As he was fortunate, I rejoice at it. As he was valiant, I honour him. But as he was ambitious, I slew him. Is not this, which I have discovered, the same sentence structure and thought contrast as in the dream thought? I thus play Brutus in the dream. If I could only find in the dream thoughts one further trace of confirmation for this astonishing collateral connection. I think the following might be such. My friend comes to Vienna in July. This detail finds no support whatever in reality. To my knowledge, my friend has never been in Vienna during the month of July. But the month of July is named after Julius Caesar, and might therefore very well furnish the required allusion to the intermediary thought that I am playing the part of Brutus. Strangely enough, I once actually played the part of Brutus. I presented the scene between Brutus and Caesar from Schiller's poems to an audience of children when I was a boy of 14 years. I did this with my nephew, who was a year older than I, and who had come to us from England, also a revenant, for in him I recognized the playmate of my first childish years. Until the end of my 3rd year we had been inseparable, had loved each other and scuffled with each other, and as I have already intimated, this childish relation had constantly determined my later feelings in my intercourse with persons of my own age. My nephew John has since found many incarnations which have revivified first one aspect, then another of this character which is so ineradicably fixed in my unconscious memory. Occasionally he must have treated me very badly, and I must have shown courage before my tyrant, for in later years I have often